For the first time since his creation, man will be faced with his real, his permanent problem. How to use his freedom from pressing economic cares. How to occupy the leisure which science and compound interest will have won for him to live wisely and agreeably and well. I look forward, therefore, in days not so very remote, to the greatest change which has ever occurred in the material environment of life for human beings.
Today on Vox Talks, whatever happened to Keynes's 15-hour work week? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. In his famous lecture, Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, that's what you heard quoted at the beginning, John Maynard Keynes predicted that no one would need to work for more than 3 hours a day by 2030. How did he get it so wrong? A new CEPR discussion paper points out that, if we look at his prediction from a different angle, it was much closer to the mark than we give him credit for. And I'm joined by the paper's author, Nick Crass, from the University of Sussex. Nick, welcome to Vox Talks.
Oh, thank you.
How did Keynes end up giving this very non-academic lecture, and how did he end up predicting a 15-hour work week, Nick?
Well, I think this started out as an after-dinner talk. And I think it was originally given to public school boys in the late 1920s, and I think he gave it a few times afterwards, lastly as a public lecture in Madrid. And I think it started out as something to amuse the public school boys. But later on, I think Keynes was essentially saying, look, we're in the Great Depression, but it won't always be this bad. You know, when we lift our eyes up to the longer term, we can see a future that potentially looks much better. I don't think, incidentally, we should really see 15 hours as a prediction. It's more Keynes musing on the idea that we won't need to work very much unless we really, really want to.
Even given the back-of-the-envelope nature of that prediction, what assumptions did he make about how our lives would change between then and, well, 100 years in the future, which is more or less now?
Following through that point about the long term, the key thing that Keynes was saying is, look, we're in an economy capable of sustained economic growth. And over time, we can expect productivity to increase. Technology will get better. This is the story since the Industrial Revolution. So Keynes looks back at where Britain's come from in 1930. And of course, there'll be investment as well. So Keynes thought that that economic growth would deliver potentially a very large increase in the standard of living. So he talks about a possible increase in income per person of somewhere between 4 to 8 times over that 100 years to 2030. In fact, if you look at 2019, the last year pre-COVID, then for the UK, it's about 5 and a bit times. So on the economic growth side, it's not so far off, you might say. By 2030, that could easily be 6, right in the middle of his range. But one quite important thing that Keynes didn't do was look carefully at how long people might live in this world of economic growth. Something we'll come back to, Tim. And he didn't actually make any assumptions at all about people's life expectancy. I think we can guess what he might have believed as an informed person in the 1930s. The most famous demographer of the period was a woman called Enid Charles, and she thought there was a definite ceiling to life expectancy, that it wouldn't go above, say, something of the order of 68, 68 and a half. Whereas, of course, it's gone quite a lot beyond that.
If we take him literally, by how far are we going to miss that 15-hour work week for our working hours? I know I'm certainly not working 15 hours a week.
In the recent past, the work week or the work year hasn't been changing a lot. It's been fairly stationary. If we took the recent past as our guide, we're talking about 1,600, 1,650 hours per year. Let's say an average of about 32 hours a week. Now, we do have quite a lot of holidays these days. The average holiday taken in Britain is about 5.8 weeks per year. So if you wanted to adjust it to hours per week when we're actually working, so to speak, then the number we'd get would be about 35. I think that essentially says Keynes was thinking of a two-thirds fall in the work week. We will probably see something which is approximately one-third over the 100 years. So looked at that way, he got it wrong by a long chalk.
Many people over the years have pointed this out about how far he was wrong in this, haven't they? But you've looked at this another way. You've looked at how much leisure time people had in 1930 and how much leisure time people are likely to have in 2030, 100 years later. And of course, that includes when we retire, which I guess is why you mentioned life expectancy, because clearly how long we expect to live is important. How long has life expectancy actually changed since 1930?
If we look at the numbers for men, women are slightly bigger, but I think Keynes was really talking about a story for men. That was his generation. Then life expectancy at birth in 1931 was 58.7.
Gosh.
Now it's about 79. If you look at life expectancy at age 65, which I think will be important for the story I want to tell you, then in 1931, that was 11.4 years. By 2011, it's 18.3 years. And what happens here is both that we've got a better chance of surviving till we're 65, the normal retirement age in 1930s, thoughts at least, and then we'll have more years of retirement afterwards. So I did a calculation that I think a 20-year-old in 1931, a reasonable guess is that the expected years of his retirement might have been about 4.66. The person, the chap coming along in 2011, the expected years of retirement, I make 16.37 on the basis of current labour force participation rates and life expectancy. So that's an increase of between 11 and 12 years. That's a lot more retirement.
Yes, if it's going to be less than 5 years, it's easy for people not to think very much about the total amount of leisure they're going to have in retirement. If you add this all up, Nick, how much time do we have for leisure now compared to a century ago? And is this going to match Keynes's prediction better?
I think if you look at the lifetime expectation of this hypothetical 20-year-old man, by now we're talking about a total lifetime leisure about 60% higher than it was in 1931. Mm-hmm. If you do the equivalent calculation for Keynes, the way he just frames it, just on this work week, not taking any idea of retirement at all for a moment, Keynes's original calculation, I think, is that leisure time would increase by about 48%. Over the period. Now, Keynes, as I think I said earlier, didn't really think about how long people would live, and he didn't do a lifetime calculation, but I've done one for him. So it would work out if we work 15 hours a week until we're 65 and then retire totally, Keynes would have expected an increase in leisure time of about 50%, because he wouldn't have been expecting very much retirement at all.
No.
So the gap is smaller than that one we looked at in comparing work weeks, but we've done a bit better than Keynes would reasonably have predicted, I think.
One of the constant emails that I'm getting now is reminding me to pay enough into my pension so I can live well in my retirement. And is one of the reasons then that we are still working these long hours rather than 15 hours a week is we have to do that. We have to fund our longer retirement so that the leisure has some meaning.
I think it's one reason. I don't think it's the only reason, but it's one that has, I think, tended to be ignored. And if you think of the way that probably many economics students are taught the so-called consumption function, many people will have come across the life cycle model. And the life cycle model does have this notion that you save in your peak earning years and then dissave when you come to retirement. That starts us off, I think, thinking in this way. For many people in the later 20th century, even until quite recently, there was compulsory retirement, effectively, at 65. So you didn't actually have the option of working till you fell over or something like that. So there were also, I think, very strong social norms that men would retire at 65. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think of people looking at their future and saying, I'm going to retire at 65. I'm probably going to have quite a long period of retirement. Mm-hmm. In principle, I could enjoy that because there are now more consumption goods. I'll be in better health than my grandfather was, etc. And if you simply think about the proportionate increase in assets that you need, given this expected longer retirement compared with 100 years ago, then you're probably wanting something of the order of 60% more assets. How do you fund these assets available to you? Well, the state pension for most people isn't going to do it. You're going to want to top up on top of that. If you look at the strategies people use, they're building up wealth in the housing market. They're being a participant in an occupational pension scheme, as well as what we might call common or garden saving. Those housing market and pension routes to high assets definitely require considerable amounts of work from most people. So I think they are a disincentive to cutting down work in your prime earning years by the extent that Keynes was thinking about it.
I'll ask you about one of the things that he did mention in this lecture. He was warning these public school boys of the 1920s about the lack of purpose that we feel if we don't have work. Is it possible that many of us are also working longer hours than we have to? Because, well, we actually quite like it at work.
I think that's probably right. I don't think it's the whole story either. Mm. But something which I think you'd see, for example, the typical academic probably falls into this category, or at least the academic who's able to spend a lot of time doing research and teaching. Mm. Perhaps not the academic who spends all their time doing admin, but that's another story. Yes, I think that is a possibility which Keynes didn't give enough thought to. But you know, if you think of it as an economist, I think you can think of several others which are also probably quite important. And as I said, I don't want to pin everything on a life cycle story. One of those is that your consumption needs are based on relative income rather than anything else. You want to keep up with the Joneses, so to speak. So I think that is an influence on how much you might want to consume. We know that the advertisers are perhaps quite good at changing your preferences. We have lots of new goods now that Keynes wouldn't have dreamt of. Keynes with a smartphone would be quite an interesting thought. And if you think about even very basic economics, I think Keynes is focusing on what we might call in simple micro terms the income effect. Mm. But actually, there's a substitution effect. The substitution effect comes from the fact that this higher income comes from much higher wage rates than people got in the 1930s. And what that implies is that the opportunity cost of leisure has gone up. So if I was teaching this to a first-year student, I think I'd say Keynes probably exaggerated the income elasticity of demand for leisure, and he forgot about the substitution effect. But then that would be par for the course. Keynes was never very good at microeconomics.
No, it is still only 2021, so it might even be too early to call this yet, Nick. And we've just had the massive economic shock from COVID-19, and clearly that's going to lead to more investment in automation, perhaps, and efficiency, because people haven't been able to go to work and employers are going to have to think about what they do about that. We're seriously considering universal basic income. Perhaps even in the future, more people can set their working hours, which is something we don't often think about. Is it possible that Keynes's 15-hour work week is still going to happen in the near future, just not quite on the schedule that he thought it would.
Yeah, I think there's something definitely to those arguments that you've just made. I still don't think we're going to get there by 2030, but you're saying maybe not that long afterwards. We are at an interesting point in the history of technology. AI and robotics hold enormous promise. They've not really affected productivity that much yet, but they easily might in future. There'll be a lot of displaced workers, perhaps, from that technological change. I think in the medium term, job opportunities of another kind will grow. The displacement effects will be matched later on, perhaps by the development of new tasks, new jobs, and so on. That's essentially what economic history would say happened in the past. So I'm not really thinking that technology is going to wipe work out, and that's something that a lot of people probably do worry about. But I think your more interesting point, in a sense, is the one about flexibility. So the issue that I'm not sure we have a good empirical answer to is how far workers at the moment feel constrained or have felt constrained, that they don't have the choices at the margin that economics typically assumes that they do. So that, I think, is an interesting question. If, however, the points I've been making about preferences, new goods, life cycle, and so on are quite strong, then maybe that flexibility will only be used a little bit rather than to the extent that you're sort of guessing it might be. Basic income? Well, I really do not think we're going to move into a world of a large universal basic income. The economics of that does not add up. So I suspect that if there is some sort of basic income, it will be at a much lower level than a level which would of itself stop people wanting to work. And maybe it would be designed just as a safety net. If it were, and it was a guarantee of universal basic income, not, as it were, a lump sum payment to everybody, then actually you'd be back to the sort of proposition that William Beveridge put forward. And Beveridge was extremely keen that his adequate income available to everybody should be sufficient to keep them out of poverty, but small enough not to make them wish to give up work. And I suspect future politicians would be designing something along those lines. So, I mean, those are all very interesting possibilities. And I think the basic thing you're saying is absolutely right. We shouldn't assume that the parameters of the world in future look exactly like the past. And so, yep, there are all sorts of ways in which it is possible that something close to Keynes's prediction could come true.
And now you've reached retirement age, if you don't mind me saying, you've managed to expand your hours of leisure time.
Not really, no. I've just changed the composition of what I do. I've taken on some new teaching. I'm still writing quite a lot of research papers, but instead of doing all the tedious academic admin, I've taken up one or two pro bono roles for the Royal Economic Society, for the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, and so on. I'm among the group who gets awfully bored after about one day of holiday.
Now, for all of you who want to read this discussion paper, it is DP16140 at the CEPR. It's called The 15-Hour Workweek, Keynes's Prediction Revisited, author Nicholas Crafts, of course. And don't forget to read the original. It's not long, it's very entertaining. It's Economic Policies for Our Grandchildren, author, of course, John Maynard Keynes, and you can easily Google that. You can find it on the internet. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the most innovative economic research every week, so subscribe to Vox Talks. You'll never miss an episode when you do. And remember, 12 years of Vox Talks at voxeu.org/vox-talks.